Court will call the case of People versus Gooley, and that's case number 07CA0080. And counsel, we are ready when you are.
I'm ready, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Gregory Lansky, bar number 38515, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes after my initial presentation. In this case, Mr. Gooley was acquitted of all charges but for the resisting arrest charge and the second degree assault charge using physical force, subsection F. After a trial and after habitual proceedings, he was sentenced to 24 years in the Department of Corrections. For the purpose of today's presentation for oral argument, I want to concentrate on my first three issues, which was raised in my opening brief. If the court has any other questions in regards to any other aspect of my brief, I'm prepared to respond to those questions. As for the first issue, the issue here is when the jury, after deliberation, submitted a question to the court instructed the jury to strike the element of lawful from the second degree assault statute. By doing so, the court relieved the jury of its burden to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. The case of People v. Marquez Lopez, cite 952 P2 780 790 Carl 1997, makes clear that the lawful is an element of the statute of second degree assault, and that the court specifically informed the jury to strike that element. And by doing so, the jury convicted Mr. Gooley of a charge which is not really a charge, you know, within the criminal statutes of Colorado.
Mr. Lansky, isn't under the statute, isn't that lawful? It's used in the statute as, lawful conviction or lawful arrest or presently in custody. It's something like that. There's in the statute. I don't remember the exact words.
I don't have a statute in front of me, but it's subsection F. And specifically, yes. Says while lawfully in confined or in custody.
Lawfully confined or in custody.
And that lawfully applies to both confined and custody. It's a disjunctive or. And that's what the case of People Marquez Lopez stands for. They said that, you know, that case had been reversed for the fact that the court did not properly instruct them on the underlying offense. And therefore, the jury did not determine whether or not he was in lawful custody or not. And that's exactly what happened in Mr. Gooley's case. And certainly the other instructions did not remedy this problem. Regards to instruction 18, regards to the officer's duties, those occurred after, while in custody. So those duties have no relevancy as to why he was in custody in the first place. As for the other instructions, 16 or 17, which deal about unlawful force, that deals with the force which was used by the officers in arresting Mr. Gooley. Does not deal with the lawfulness of the underlying basis for his arrest. So certainly the other instructions do not, you know, remedy the court's mistake by striking the lawful requirement, you know, in the statute. In addition, the evidence was far from overwhelming in this case. And this is a situation where the officers made initial contact to Mr. Gooley while Mr. Gooley was on his own property. There was really the central premise or the defense for this case was the fact that he was not in lawful custody, and that in fact the officers had no basis to have him under arrest. And there's another issue in regards to the credibility of the officers here. There was mace used in this incident. Children were maced. Children were sent to the hospital. It was argued at the trial that in fact that what was going on here is that the officers were trying to cover up for their actions, which injured, you know, people who were in his property. But it's very important to understand this all took place in Mr. Gooley's property. He never left his property. It was uncontested about that fact. It was uncontested the fact that that the officers made initial contact to Mr. Gooley. And for that reason alone, I think the second degree assault conviction needs to be reversed. As for my second and third...
Excuse me, didn't the court confer with counsel on this issue about the instruction?
Well, what happened is that the question was, you know, what is lawfully confined? And then the court says, well, we're gonna strike lawfully confined and say while in custody.
Defense counsel, there was no objection to that. In fact, there was more than that. There was an argument, we got to do it another way, and the court went defense counsel's way.
I think that's for the second issue in regards to...
I thought it was on this issue, too.
I think in this issue, I think all it was just the court said this is the response, and there was no objection, and I agree that the analysis here... I put in my brief that it should be a constitutional harmless error analysis, but I understand that the analysis based on Miller is a plain error review here. But there was no objection, but there's certainly not invited error in this situation. The court certainly made this in response to the question, we're going to strike lawfully, and lawfully is an element of this statute, and because of that, the state was relieved of its constitutional burden to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, for my second and third argument, and I think the second and third argument I'm going to state together because I think they are interrelated. But here again, after deliberations, the jury came back with a question. And the question was, what's the difference? What is defining arresting someone? What defines arresting someone? And how does being arrested differ from being taken in custody? In response, the court only responded to the first question, what defines arrested someone? The court did not respond to the jury's second question, how does being arrested differ from being taken in custody? And that second question is crucial to this case because there's a relationship between resisting arrest and second degree assault. And that relationship is that a resisting arrest must precede the second degree assault. And that's the holding of the Supreme Court case, People v. Armstrong, which says that's the reason why it does not violate equal protection grounds. Obviously, by this question, the jury was confused about this issue. In fact, the fact that the jury is saying how is being arrested different from being taken in custody is not an issue in this case. It's while in custody. So the jury was under the assumption that they can actually convict Mr. Gooley of second degree assault based on this act which occurred prior to him being in custody. And there's a reason why they thought that. If you look at the closing arguments of the prosecutor, both in his initial closing arguments and his rebuttal closing argument, he says, you can convict Mr. Gooley while he's being taken into custody for second degree assault because he's resisting the arrest. I can quote right here, it says, from October 24, 2007, page 39, this is actually the rebuttal argument. It says, not until he hears the word tase that he gives up. That what takes him to get him to stop resisting arrest, to stop assaulting the officers. What the prosecutor is arguing here is saying that resisting arrest and the conduct for resisting arrest and the conduct for second degree assault are one and the same thing. And that is in direct contravention to the holding of People v. Armstrong. Again, page 14, lines 18 to 20, there's a direct quote from the prosecutor. He's saying, when he's being put into custody and he's resisting, that's using physical force against the officers while he's in custody. No, that's not. That's resisting arrest. And that's what Armstrong speaks to. And that's why the jury was confused. And that's why the court had an obligation to alleviate that confusion and say, no, you know what? There is a relationship between a resisting arrest and second degree assault. And that relationship is a sequential relationship. One cannot be in custody until, in fact, the arrest is effectuated. And that was never stated to the jury at all. And therefore, Mr. Gulish was only convicted for this charge for the same conduct prior to when he was in custody.
You're objecting to the question or to the instruction?
Am I objecting to the question or the instruction?
The answer to the question or to the instruction. The instruction was correct, was it not?
Well, actually, the instruction, what they said, for arrest or for custody? The question was, what defines arresting someone? There is no definition by case law what is arresting someone. The definition, the proper response would be what constitutes and effectuates an arrest. And that's what People Armstrong speaks to, saying if there's an arrest and an arrest is resisted, then the arrest is not effectuated until he's reasonably, he cannot move, from that prison. In fact,
my second question then is the facts in this case. Didn't one of the officers testify, he came at me and I told him to get back, didn't answer, I grabbed his arm, and then he grabbed a hold of him, as I understood, and then he pulled out his mace and he sprayed the group And then the whole bunch of them all fell to the ground, and then defendant kicked or assaulted the officer.
Well, that's the, that not really ties into my third argument here.
But right here, you're trying to separate arrest, custody, resist, and say that they weren't separated, as I understand the way you're arguing.
Well, way the court instructed a jury, they didn't have to find they were separated. I mean, some of that was the evidence that was presented, but we didn't know what the jury did.
Wasn't this an issue of invited error, though? Didn't the defense counsel say, I want this instruction and no others?
What happened, the question is this, you know, what defines arresting someone? Again, and the response was by the court, an arrest is whether the officer, by means of physical force or show of authority, has in some way restrained the liberty of the citizen. The initial response was the process of putting someone in custody. And the objection was correct because of the fact Ortega stands for the proposition, People v. Ortega says that, you know, formal arrest does not necessarily need to, precede custody. And in fact, that's what the judge in the district court said, you know what, my initial response, that may be wrong. I'm reading Ortega right now, and that in fact may be wrong. In addition,
what was defense counsel want here? That was the question I ask, is not kind of like, gee, was the instruction correct or not correct? What did defense counsel ask for, and what did defense counsel ask not to be done?
What the problem is that this issue is not clarified in the law. The issue is, what is arresting someone? So there is no proper response. And what the defense counsel wanted to do, she did not think the process wasn't a complete definition for arrest. And I think it's not a complete definition of arrest. I think there's more. In addition, pursuant to People v. Stewart, there needs to be a strategic benefit here, you know, if it's going to be invited error. And in this case, there was no strategic benefit. It would have been in the benefit of defense for them to say, hey, there's a relationship. He needs to be in custody first before there is, you know, there's an assault. And that relationship was never stated to the jury, and it was not in the interest of, to defense counsel to tell that to the jury. You know, pursuant to People v. Stewart, you know, there was no strategic benefit here. If the instruction for Armstrong was given, would have been a lot more consistent with the defense closing. And in regards to my third argument, there's a policy issue here. The reason why there's a higher sentence for second-degree assault as opposed to resisting arrest is because the officer is more prone to injury after the arrest is effectuated because he's calmed down and he's now no longer an alert. That is not the situation in this case here. The officers testified that this happened in a matter of seconds, fraction of seconds is the words they use. Certainly the policy argument, you know, for the higher sentence is not applicable in this case. And look at the case of People v. Armstrong, the seminal case on this issue. Look at the dissent and concurrent opinion. The facts of Armstrong was that with a 4 or 5 minute altercation where the officers held on to Mr. Armstrong, they fell to the ground, they went back up, they went back down to the ground, there was hitting, there was kneeing, over a 4 or 5 minute span. And with the dissent and concurrent opinion said, you know what, even though it's not before us, even though the equal protection argument's before us right now, this case should have been dismissed for lack of probable cause because, you know what, this was just resisting arrest. This was not second-degree assault.
Yeah, less than 2 minutes. I just want to remind you of
sure.
that. Okay.
And, you know, in this case, the officers testified for seconds, minutes. You know, that's it, seconds. So the policy argument is not there in this case. I mean, this all happened with one continuous event. And even the majority in Armstrong stated that, you know, one of the things that the jury needs to look at to see whether his efforts to resist arrest had stopped once he was in custody. That is not the situation here. There was no break. Everything was continuous here. This was a resisting arrest. And I'd like to reserve based on that at this point, Judge.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman and I represent the people in this matter. I will also focus my argument on the first three issues raised by the defendant, and I'd be happy to address the other issues if the court would like. To answer Judge Marquez's question, my recollection of the record is that on the first issue, it is a plain error issue rather than an invited error. I think the defense did agree with the removing the lawfully confined language. So that's my recollection of the record. It's been a while since I've looked at it.
Defense did agree to the removal of the lawful?
Lawfully confined language, yes.
Okay, so if the defense agreed, is that a plain error or is it an invited error?
Well, I had argued it was plain error. I suppose if there's some argument that it was a strategic choice under Stewart, it could rise to the level of invited error. So I would hesitate to concede that without thinking about it a little bit more. But I had argued that it was plain error, and I think even under a plain error standard, the defendant's claim fails. I just wanted to provide a little context, which I don't think I focused on so much in the analysis of this, which is the issue that was really being under the facts here that was being argued by the defense was not whether the officer had the lawful authority to take the defendant into custody, but was the officer using unlawful physical force in that contact. It wasn't until I really sat down and read the reply brief that I thought it seems that what the defendant narrowed it to is whether the officer has the legal authority to take the defendant into custody. I don't think that was in dispute at all, so I don't think that would even rise to the level of plain error. Judge Hawthorne, your point, I'm not sure that we require under Colorado law that the taking of custody actually be in with legal authority. But again, I think the context of the instructions here and the argument by the defense was not that the officer had no legal authority to take him into custody, but rather that the officer was essentially using excessive force against the defendant or someone else, and that the defendant was trying to defend against that. I think the instructions here did not in any manner inform the jury that unlawful custody, whether legal authority or excessive force, was proper. Here, I think when you look at the instructions together, the elemental instruction for second-degree assault, which requires that the act of the assault take place when the officer is engaged in the performance of his duties, and the definitional instruction that is the counterpart to that, which says that an officer engaged in the performance of his duties is acting on duties that are imposed, authorized, required, or permitted by law. So that in order for the act of assault to violate the statute, the officer must be engaged in his lawful duties. The other component is the in custody part, which the definition of says in custody means physical control over the person being detained so as to reasonably ensure the person does not leave. Now this describes the character of the custody as a reasonable level of physical control. I think that also frames the lawfulness of the officer's conduct in this situation properly. I think all of these together say that the officer's conduct must, in keeping the defendant in custody, must be authorized by law. And then also the defendant's theory of the defense is the affirmative defense that he was acting against an unlawful use of physical force by the officer. That's the focus of the argument. If you look at the arguments in closing of defense counsel, the argument is never that the officer never had legal authority to arrest or place in custody the defendant, but rather that the use of force was excessive. Let's see, I'll move on. If there's no questions about the first issue, I'll move on to the second issue. I do think this is an invited error situation. As to Judge Daly's question, the defense counsel refused the instruction that would have done what the defense now claims was required, which is an explanation that the arrest precedes the custody. I think the instructions here sufficiently informed the jury of the relationship between the act, the resisting arrest, which was the act of preventing the effecting of an arrest, and the being in custody, which is being detained instruction.
Let me ask you about the second instruction, counsel, because you seem to have indicated that, yeah, for invited error at the bar, there's got to be strategic reason. What strategic reason would there have been for not having the instructions clarify the relationship between arrest and custody?
Well, I think what defense counsel was trying to focus on was actually getting an instruction that I would say gave a heightened requirement for what constituted an arrest, and that that this supported, I think, their position that there was never even an arrest that took place here because there was no restraint of the liberty of a citizen is what I think the definition that we ultimately ended up with. So I think that was a strategic choice in getting something that they thought favored their theory about what was going on in the case, and that's why they focused on that. But clearly they rejected the instruction that the arrest preceded the taking in custody. And just as a side note to that, and I don't think it's significant to this case in particular, but you don't actually have to have an arrest to have someone in custody. We have other case law, and I can't name the case off the top of my head, where there's a custodial stop, essentially, to investigate, where there's no arrest at all. So you could have a second-degree assault while someone's in custody without an arrest. Now, here the sequence of events happen to relate to this effort to arrest the defendant, where there's a resisting that happens first, and then there's the subsequent holding of the defendant on the ground when he kicks the officer, where there's he is in custody. But
even in your scenario about custody, isn't there a submission to custody? Either the person submits to custody or custody is effectuated over the individual. In this case, when was custody effectuated?
I think custody was effectuated. I think this is what the prosecutor argued. Once the officer took hold of the defendant, had him on the ground, and then I think the other officers are also holding him down, and then he is kicked. So I think
does custody suggest some degree of control? Because if it does, if you're wrestling around on the ground and he's still kicking at you, that doesn't suggest he's in the control of the police officer.
Well, and I this is a good point, Your Honor, only because I thought of it earlier. That's why I think it's a good point. And I don't think in custody requires that there's this sort of calm, peaceful moment when the defendant is no longer resisting being in custody. I think
does custody require control?
It requires a level of control to ensure that they will not leave.
Where is the control in this case?
They're holding the defendant on the ground, and I don't think he ever leaves at that point. I think that's the point where he is under control, where they've ensured that he won't leave. Granted, he's still fighting and he's obviously assaulting the officer, but they have enough physical control over him to ensure that he won't leave. And to dodge the question somewhat, the jury found that this was sufficient evidence to support such a finding under the instructions. And I think the evidence supports that here.
How do you respond to defendant's arguments under Armstrong that there is a need for a break between the resisting arrest activities and the being in custody activities? And where was that break?
All right.
Here?
And I went back and reread the language in Armstrong several times because that one sentence is a little bit of a puzzle. And because it's unclear whether it means a break in the defendant's actions or, in other words, one act occurred here where he was resisting arrest, and then at some point later there's this effort to assault the officer while in custody. That seems to be what the language says narrowly. Or is it that you can define when there was an effort to arrest that was resisted and a point where there has become custody where we're ensuring that he's not able to leave? I think break, again, doesn't mean this calm moment where the defendant has given up resisting and said, okay, I'm now in custody, and then he assaults the officer. I think what it means is that we can define by the facts when these events occur, and that they are in fact all, and again, is a question for the jury. That's clear from what Armstrong says, is there a clearly defined moment where he's in custody and he assaults the officer.
Very defined moment when he's in custody, of which an objective observer would reasonably believe that he's not free to leave. At the time he's kicking the officer, isn't it somewhat questionable as to whether he'll get away or not?
Yeah, I suppose it's sure. I mean, until we know what happens at the end of the story, we never know what's going to happen.
But at that point in time, when he's kicking the officer, would a reasonable, objective observer looking at it go like, well, you know, he's not going anywhere?
I think a reasonable observer would find, or could, how about that, could find, because I think this jury did, that he was under sufficient restraint by the officers that he was, they had ensured that he was unable to leave. I think the evidence supports that. You know, reading the record, none of us were there, and myself included, to see the officer's description of what happened. My recollection is one of the officers seemed very disturbed by the experience. Other officers seemed more comfortable with how it had happened. I just mean from a personal emotional point of view. So without being there to see them talk about their description and the emphasis they gave to these things, it's difficult to assess those things. And certainly we could say, gee, to me this sounds like they were all out of control, but I think the evidence shows that these officers used their skills and their understanding of the correct procedures to take control of the defendant, and ultimately they did. So I think that supports the finding here by the jury on that point.
For any point in time before the kick of which, you know, you think a jury could properly infer that he was under the control of the police officers?
I think arguably when the officer took hold of him, when he was trying to defend himself from the oncoming group by spraying the OC spray, I think is what it was called, that at that point he had taken control. And again, this was after the acts that had been the resisting the arrest, where the officer initially had tried to grab him when he came at the officer. And at that point, that's it, at the very least, that's the beginning of taking custody, of taking control. But certainly the officer's description of, I pulled him to me so that I could defend myself, sounds like he's got pretty good control over him. Ultimately, when they're all on the ground and he's on top of him, I think that's another point where the jury could find that he was in custody.
You're thinking that's a jury question at that point?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's what Armstrong tells us, albeit they have this one comment that this is just one factor for the jury to consider in determining whether the defendant is in custody, whether there's this break between the resisting arrest and the being in custody and committing the assault. And I think one of the things is that's, I think, precisely what the defense tried to argue was, look, there isn't even any arrest here. If you look at the closing argument, they're trying to stir that issue and argue, look, there was never any custody here. And obviously the jury considered that and rejected it in this case. I think I've covered the three issues. If there aren't any further questions, I would thank the court for its time.
Just to respond to whether he's objectively in custody. I think Armstrong sets forth that objective standard does not apply in second-degree assault. That objective standard is for Miranda purposes, whether someone's in custody. I mean, Armstrong stands for the opposite. And I think in this situation where, you know, all there is essentially, you know, after initial contact is resistance, as the prosecutor argued in his closing, you know, while they're trying to take him into custody, he's resisting. Even the prosecutor doesn't agree to sufficient evidence, you know, for second-degree assault.
Well, let me ask you, the question that the prosecutor may have misspoken or mistaken the elements, that doesn't make it a sufficiency of the evidence issue.
It confuses the jury as to the sequential relationship.
It may have confused the jury, but that's not one of the arguments on appeal. You have an instructional issue and you have sufficiency of the evidence, as I understand.
The argument for closing speaks to the issue why they were confused, and that's why there is an issue for the instruction issue, because of the fact they were confused based on that. And for policy purposes, you know, this was resisting arrest because based on the policy, what you try to do here is to avoid injury when the officer is not prepared. This was one continuous action, and there was insufficient evidence based on that. It was contrary to the policy for the second-degree assault statute. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Yes. Thank both of you for your excellent arguments this afternoon. They will be helpful to us. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our 1:30 docket this afternoon, and the court will stand in recess, and the bailiff may so announce. Thank you.